on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I don't know about you, but I'm still shaking my head about just how improbable this connection is. The Vietnam vet whose ex-POW father died 20 years ago drives to Fresno, California for an appointment at the VA. While waiting, he meets a man who was in the same POW camp, the same barracks, even knew his father. We heard from Coarse Gold California's Les Beck about how much it means to him and how much it's added to his understanding of his dad. But now Les and the rest of you get to listen to 95-year-old Orville Lewis of Orange Cove, California. So let's hear this from your perspective. When this young man stops you at the VA, asks you about your 8th Air Force hat, and tells you that his dad was in the same POW camp as you and shot down 4 days apart, did you believe him?
I sure did. I'd been waiting, hoping to run into someone that come in contact with that I knew in prison camp, and this was it. And it kind of surprised me.
I could imagine so. And you got out of that prison camp 70 years ago. Have you had contact with anyone from the camp since?
Yes. I met Ernie Lewis, who happened to be on the crew of Les's dad, and he lived in Eureka, California, and I was real good buddies with him, and I went up and visited with him, and he is the only one I've ever come in contact with except until I met Les.
But you always kind of had that in the back of your mind, that that would be neat if that could happen?
Yes, it sure did, and I tried to find someone. I just never had been able to.
What have you gotten out of this so far? I know you guys are just getting to know each other, but what has it meant to you to spend this time with Les?
Well, it kind of sure brings back some memories. I really enjoyed talking to Les on everything. And if I can help him remember something about his dad, I'd be glad to do so. And I've got a lot of stories I could tell him. Probably make his hair stand on end, but I've still got them there. I'll tell him about them.
What do you remember about his father?
Well, all I remember about him, he was a very quiet guy. He wasn't boisterous or outgoing, but he was quiet and soft-spoken and a real nice guy.
And when we talk about being in the same barracks, help us understand how amazing that is. How many people would have been in your barracks, and how close was his father to where you stayed?
Well, the barracks were divided into two parts. There's 160 men on each end of the barracks. This father happened to be in the same end that I was in the barracks. I remember the number of it was 36. His bunk was about 10 feet one direction and about 20 feet the other, about 30 feet away from where I slept. That was just about all I can tell you about the location. We were very fortunate to be in the same end of the barracks, and it's very unusual to have met someone that knew anyone in my end of the barracks.
Yeah, it's really hard to believe. Let's go back. I want to get your story. So you grew up in northeastern Oklahoma. What was your hometown?
My hometown was Ainola, a little Indian town. And it was near Claremore and Tulsa and Muskogee. I was just kind of in a triangle there. And I grew up there on a farm, and that's all I knew at the time. I went through school, and when I was in my junior year of high school, I got the itchy feet. I took off. I ran around all over the country, rode freight trains, bummed around, and had a good time. And I got a good education for 3 years. But I went back to school, and I made the honor roll.
You said you got a good education riding the rails, hoboing, huh?
Yes, I did. And I even got thrown in jail.
What'd you do?
Well, there's five of us rode horses in this little old town called Porham. And we decided to have a horse race down Main Street. And we did. The police there didn't seem to enjoy that, so they took us and put us in jail.
Because they weren't your horses?
No, they weren't our horses, but we didn't steal them. We borrowed them. And anyway, all those guys got paid out. I got their fines paid, and except a cousin of mine. And we was in a jail that had been condemned by the state, who's in charge of state jails. They'd made it out of two by fours and wagon tires. And we sprung the wagon tires out and broke jail and ran off. They had the highway patrol. They had officers all over running us. We ran up and down the mountain and got away from them. I went out in Arizona where my grandparents were. And my cousin's dad paid his fine and got him out of it, but I never did have to pay it. But I went back to Muskogee one day to visit my uncle, and he said, come around the corner here. Guy I want to introduce you to. and it happened to be the one of the officers that chased us over the hills. Like we were bad guys. We weren't.
Well, obviously you remembered him, but did he remember you?
Yes. Yes, he did. I was kind of surprised he remembered me, but he did.
Well, here I'm thinking it's amazing that you've met the son of someone you were in the prison camp with 70 years later, but now I'm amazed that you even made it into World War II after what you were up to before World War II. And you mentioned growing up on a farm and taking off when you did. Was part of that the economic situation? Was it pretty tough there during the Depression?
It was very tough during the Depression. I remember my dad working for 15 cents an hour to get a little cash in their pockets to eat on. And also, we finally got a job. There was four of us boys, one younger than me and two older than me. And there's a rich oil man from Tulsa. I went to a place down there, and he had a gravel pit. And we would shovel gravel for him, $1.50 a day for 8 hours, each one of us. So we made $6 a day. That was big money. But I still remember that. But it was tough. But my father always, he was a good butcher. And he butchered about four or five big hogs every year. We had beef. We ate good. I thought it was terrible, the food we had, but I'd go to town and spend the night with my friends, eat that light bread, we called it, and stuff, and it was real good. And they'd get just as big a kick when they come home with me and eat the old country food. We ate food that was canned. Mom always had a big garden, and we ate good. We didn't have any money, but we did eat good.
I know that's in the Cherokee Nation area, or what?
Yes, it is. It's in the old Cherokee Strip. And in fact, right in front of our house, they had the cement marker, Mason-Dixon line, and that was within 100 yards of where I lived.
Well, I'm sure you have a million more stories from those years. You've given us just a hint, and they're pretty wild, but I'm interested in finding out how you ended up in the Army Air Corps. Were you thinking about aviation at a young age, or where'd that come from?
No, I had volunteered for every branch of the service, and I passed all of them, but my buddy failed. So I didn't go into any of them. I passed Marine tests and everything, but being my buddy couldn't get in, I was waiting to be drafted. Well, I went out in Arizona where my grandparents was, and when I was there, they called me back in Oklahoma. The time I got back there, the bunch that they called me for had already went in. So I was working for a neighbor, an old man and an old lady. They had a lot of acreage, and I was up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I worked till dark at night for them, and they thought the world of me, and they treated me like I was their own son. Well, I kept waiting to be called, and they didn't call me, so I asked him. I said, you know what? Something is wrong. I'm going up and find out how come they haven't called me, because I'm going in. A lot of the kids around here have all gone in, and I haven't gone. He said, well, I can tell you why. He said, I'm on a committee that says who stays on the farm and who goes to the service. And he happened to be on that committee. And I tell you, well, that's it. I'm sorry, but I'm going to go in and turn myself in and get that gone. He said, okay, but you'll never be the same when you come back. So I did. I went in, and in a couple of days, I took the oath. It was the 30th of July, 1942, and I was in Fort Sill, Oklahoma for a few days, and they sent me down to Florida, and I took basic training as an infantry. They pulled us out and gave us an interrogation, and they put me in the Air Corps, Army Air Corps. And from there, I went to airplane mechanic school and went through that, and then to aero gunnery school in Las Vegas. And from there, we went to Wendover, Utah, and training, and from there to Boise, Idaho, and ended up ready to go overseas down in Kansas.
Yeah, they got you ready in a hurry, because you were over there pretty early as far as the air war in Europe goes from an American perspective. I want to ask you about something else before I forget, because every veteran that I've talked to seems to have a memory of December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were when you found out that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor?
I sure do. I was at Casa Grande, Arizona with my grandparents. And, oh, I was ready to volunteer right then. So that's why I went back to Oklahoma.
Most of the guys that are still around who flew bombing missions in Europe are guys that flew it later on in 1944 or even 1945. There aren't too many of you around who actually flew bombing missions in 1943. And part of the reason is so many of you got shot down. A lot of guys got killed, or like you, they ended up as prisoners of war. But when you went over there, do you remember what you felt, what you expected, what you were looking forward to?
I remember real well. We left out of Goose Bay, Newfoundland, we flew over in a B-17, old Classy Chassis was their name, and got over halfway, we hit a terrible storm, and our buddy, another plane was flying with us, and we tried to get above it, couldn't, we tried to get below it, we couldn't, so we leveled off and hit it at 12,000 feet. It threw us around like a ball, well, I don't know, just a paper bag or something all over the air. The two pilots just handled the control, and I handled the de-icers, the carburetors, and everything. As flight engineer, I took care of the instruments. And we made it through, but it took 2 to 3 hours, and it used a lot of fuel. We had Tokyo tanks. I pumped those tanks. The lay was practically empty, and we got over Scotland, and there was fog. We couldn't land, and my pilot went back in the radio room. He wanted me to throw out everything in the plane. No, I won't do that. And the co-pilot said, no, don't let him do it. And so the co-pilot had the map out and tracing. I was flying the plane. The pilot was back talking to the radio room trying to get contact with someone. And here came some Spitfires, English Spitfires. And they guided us into an airport there in Scotland. We were supposed to land in England. We landed, I checked, we had maybe 10 to 15 minutes of fuel left. And we sat down. So we got fuel, and the next day we went to England. And we landed at an airport there, it was the wrong one. We were supposed to went to Thetford, England. I looked at those planes, the windshield shot out, plane shot up, everything. And I wondered what in the world I got into. What did I get into this for? Well, they told us we were wrong, so we went over to Thetford, England. And I tell you, I just didn't know what I was getting into.
Well, it sounds like it was almost over for you before it began. You're not even there yet. And on the flight there, you hit this horrible storm. And your captain actually tells you, get rid of all that stuff. We need to get rid of stuff so we're lighter and we can actually make it. And you've got 10 or 15 minutes of fuel left. Were you a little scared throughout that time?
Well, I wasn't too comfortable, no. But I'll tell you one thing. Our buddy didn't like it through the storm. They went down. They never showed up anywhere. Yes, I was scared because that plane was being thrown around, and when it landed, I looked, the fuselage, the wings were bright 2 inches out where they moved up and down on that fuselage. It was a tough plane, the only way we made it through.
I guess so. So just so everyone at home knows what you're saying, besides being almost out of fuel, those wings were so loose by the time you got there that who knows how close they were to snapping right off and sending you down into the drink.
That's correct, 100% right. That's all that happened once before here in the States. We hit a thunderstorm. We were flying at 21,000 feet. We hit that and it blew us out of control. The pilot said at least 2 dozen times in that thunderhead. I went back to get the crew out. We had parachutes all over the plane, and grabbed the first one you could find, and the door was frozen and the pin rusted in that. No one jumped, so here came the pilot and said, okay, so don't jump. They got the plane under control. Just things like that. And I realized that in that storm, that could happen again very easily.
You had some pretty close calls before you even got into combat. And I'll talk about your missions here in a moment. But help us understand what your duties were on that plane. You mentioned being the flight engineer. You've got a lot of different things you're going to have to do. Give us a little nutshell sketch of what you understood your duties to be.
My duty was to keep the logbook up at par. I had to put every man's name down it, every flight, where we went, time of the flight, and there was a record so we could keep the hours up on the plane and when it needed overhaul. And when the pilot wasn't on the plane, I was in charge of the airplane, no one else. And I had to go through the link trainer flight training, just like the aviators did in that time. And I was able to fly the plane, which I did. I got a lot of stick time, so in case the pilot, co-pilot were killed, I could fly the crew back. Well, I had all that training, but I had also took a short course in navigation, and I worked with a bombardier all the time. But any man placed on a plane, I had to be able to take over. And as a flight engineer, that was a big job.
And I guess you would have been at that time, what, about 23?
Yeah, I was 23.
Did that make you one of the older guys on the crew?
No, the head assistant was 35-year-old. The navigator was around 35. But the rest of the crew, yes, I was grandpa.
Well, tell me about that first mission. Were you a little excited to make this real, or had that passed you by?
Worried. I had all kinds of visions of what could happen. We'd had training on what to look for, and it was my duty as being a top turret gunner, a flight engineer, you're on top there, to call out any planes coming in, a position of them and everything. Yes, I was worried, plenty.
Yeah, so if the records from the 388th Bomb Group are correct, your first mission, July 17th, 1943, the target was Amsterdam, and it's noted that Anne Frank in the Diary of Anne Frank actually mentions hearing the bombers come over that night. But I saw a note on there that your plane, Lieutenant Pickard, was your pilot, and you guys came back a little early, it said, because of poor radio communications. Did you remember that?
I remember it real well, because we were talking to each other on the intercom. We were broadcasting all over Europe. So they called us back. And the funny part about it was they put us on another plane, and I looked at it, and the guns were laying out in the sand, had blown in it, and no one had took care of those guns. And I understand they put those on exhibition. I told the pilot, we're not taking this plane. He started kind of using some words I won't repeat. And the officers of the camp there, they came out and looked, they agreed with me. Nope, you don't fly those planes. The guns wouldn't work.
So you guys took off at a little before 6:30 in the morning with almost 20 more planes. But an hour and 20 minutes later, you came back because what you said, when you use the radio, everybody was hearing it? Wasn't supposed to be that way.
That's correct. We were broadcasting all over Europe instead of just locally communicating within the plane.
So in other words, hey, Luftwaffe, if you want to shoot us down, we're right here.
Correct.
But thankfully that didn't happen. You come back and the other plane, and it was you that recognized that those guns, they wouldn't have fired.
That's right. I was the first one on a plane and I saw those guns there. They were sand, the wind had been blowing. I don't know how the sand got in there.
That's kind of interesting. There are two things that could have gone really wrong there, but you guys avoid both of those, and it almost seems like it's foreshadowing that eventually something is going to go wrong for you. Your next mission was a week later, July 24th of 43. Bergen, Norway was the target, and you actually got to complete that mission?
We completed it, but we did not drop our bombs because it was cloudy and it had to be pinpoint bombing. And we did not drop bombs. There wasn't a plane dropped a bomb. We brought them back.
Is this starting to get a little frustrating that things aren't going according to plan?
Well, I was kind of glad that day I didn't get shot at. It was the only milk run we had.
That means the rest of your missions were pretty intense, and we're going to explore that when we come back. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of Orville Lewis as well as his newfound friend, Les Beck. I still can't believe the way they met. More of Orville Lewis's 1943 adventures in the skies over Europe when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
From the creators of Courageous and Fireproof comes War Room, a powerful new film about fighting life's battles in prayer.
This is my favorite place in this house. I call it my war room.
Because prayer is a powerful weapon. War Room, now playing. Starring Alex Kendrick, Priscilla Shirer, and Beth Moore.
We need an army of believers. Raise them up, Lord. Raise them up.
Rated PG, parental guidance suggested. Tickets and showtimes available now at warroomthemovie.com.